That was Ninja Theme. I'll see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Britain is reportedly set to increase the number of nuclear warheads it can stockpile for the first time since the end of the Cold War. A European Parliament debate has been told that more than 100 million people in the EU live in poverty. We'll have a report from Brussels. Also coming up, the United States designates 5 Chinese technology companies, including Huawei, as a threat to its national security. It's good to have you with us. Our top story: Britain reportedly plans to increase the number of its stockpiled nuclear warheads for the first time since the end of the Cold War. A report by The Guardian says a review of defence and foreign policy would see an increase of the number of warheads, which currently stands at 180. The review is set to be released next week. The last defence review in 2015 committed the UK to reducing the numbers of operationally available warheads to 120. The increase is said to be aimed at persuading the US to co-fund a replacement for UK nuclear weapons, also known as the Trident nuclear program. Britain has been heavily dependent on US technology to operate its nuclear warheads over the past 60 years. Political commentator John Wright says Britain wants to convey this message to Washington that the UK is still part of the US hegemonic apparatus.
And in the throes of Brexit, this is a desperate attempt to shore up Britain's fading prestige on the world stage as a major power and trying to prove to Washington that it is still part of Washington's hegemonic apparatus and is still a valued partner. It is no secret that the Biden administration looks poorly on Brexit, and this is a desperate attempt, as I say, to compensate for the ravages of Brexit. 40% less exports to the EU from the UK in January after Brexit was completed, and 29% reduction in imports from the EU to the UK. That tells its own story on the realities of Brexit. And here's another thing. Trident is a nuclear deterrent based in Scotland, in Fars Lane on the west coast of Scotland, and it is a hot button issue for people who support Scottish independence. The main Scottish Nationalist Party, the SNP, is against Trident, and so this is going to only inflame passions when it comes to the argument in favour of Scottish independence. This is British nationalism, it is failing, and it will not in any way cover for the reality of Brexit, which is a disaster.
A European Parliament debate has been told that more than 100 million people in the EU live in poverty. Lawmakers say social justice measures being pursued by the European Commission lack ambition. Jerome Hughes reports.
Social Rights Commissioner Nicola Schmidt has presented plans in the European Parliament to lift 15 million people living in the 27-nation EU out of poverty by 2030. Lawmakers, though, seem less than convinced.
Let us be honest, these are not new problems. We have to renew our approach and our methods if we are to succeed. The Commission must coordinate better with the Member States on social targets.
MEPs say poverty affects more than 100 million people in the EU. Apparently, the bloc's handling of the COVID-19 crisis is making matters worse due to the economic fallout.
President von der Leyen has accumulated disaster upon disaster. Millions of vaccines never showed up as promised. The EU is responsible, and a high price tag has been paid by so many citizens.
All that is required to ensure social justice is political will, it has been suggested.
Despite the fact that homelessness has increased by 70% in the last 10 years, we collectively show that if we want to, we can provide people with a home.
During the debate, lawmakers said there are too many poor quality jobs in the EU, too many pay cuts, too many people sleeping on the streets, too many words, and not enough action. According to experts, moves by EU nations to privatise essential services such as healthcare are impacting the poorest.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
We are told, due to three key reasons, economic uncertainty remains extremely high in the 19-country eurozone.
Persistently high rate of coronavirus infection, the spread of virus mutations, and the associated extension and tightening of containment measures.
In May, EU leaders are due to hold a social summit in Portugal. They will go there knowing that previous targets to reduce social inequality in the EU were not met. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Staying in the region, Catalonia's new parliament has held its first session following a regional election, which saw pro-independence parties win a majority. During the session, lawmakers picked a radical separatist for their speaker. José Patri brings us more from Catalonia.
The pro-independence majority in Catalonia's newly elected parliament has picked radical separatist Laura Borràs for speaker, paving the way for the election of a new coalition government within 2 weeks. The former culture minister, who is an ally of exiled ex-president Carles Puigdemont, set the tone for the upcoming legislature.
The legislature that starts today must be a watershed towards achieving independence of Catalonia, as expressed by more than half of the citizens of this region.
Borràs was stripped of her immunity as member of Spain's Congress last year, after she was accused of misuse of public funds when she was in charge of the Institute of Catalan Letters.
She has always denied the charges, saying that she is being investigated because she is an outspoken separatist.
Putting up a challenge to Borràs's separatists are members of the far-right Vox, who made their way into Catalan politics for the first time in the 2021 vote. They have vowed to break the seemingly united separatists. However, a majority of lawmakers agreed to erect a cordon sanitaire around the populist party, which won 11 seats in the February election.
Vox will be barred from holding any position of power in the Bureau of Parliament, despite being eligible for one.
The far-right party leader in Catalonia vowed to fight back.
Vamos a ser su peor pesadilla.
We'll be their worst nightmare and we'll fight them on all fronts, in parliaments, in courts and in society. We'll fight to regain this Catalonia they've hijacked.
The next stage for Catalan lawmakers is the election of a president for the region. Former Vice President Pere Aragonès from the Republican Left Party of Catalonia is the likely candidate. Is a firm believer in the independence of Catalonia from Spain, but unlike the Speaker of Parliament, he advocates a more moderate approach with the central government in Madrid.
With a speaker under investigation and a spectacular breakthrough for the far right, Catalonia's parliament is off to a rocky start. For now, the road ahead is clear for the pro-independence majority to form a government and get down to business. Except this time, the man at the helm in the Generalitat will be holding out an olive branch in one hand and the Estelada flag in the other. Kasai Kadri, Barcelona.
Elsewhere, the United States has designated five Chinese technology companies, including Huawei and ZTE, as a threat to its national security. The Federal Communications Commission said the list is aimed at preventing next-generation networks from using services that can pose a risk to the security and safety of Americans. The designation came under a 2019 law that was enacted to protect U.S. communication networks. The law required the FCC to identify foreign companies potentially posing threats to national security. Firms like Huawei and ZTE had been blacklisted previously under the same law. Huawei had challenged the U.S. move in court but has now declined to comment on the new designation. Well, China has called on the United States to bring the bilateral relations between the two countries on the right track. This comes as tensions increase between the two economic powers over a variety of issues, including Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea.
Tensions heat up between the United States and China again over the same old issues, which have always been a source of animosities between the world's two top economies. It was widely believed that the new U.S. administration would make changes to its foreign policy, but it seems it's still following in the footsteps of its predecessor. Amid their diplomatic row, China has once again urged the United States to stop interfering in Hong Kong's affairs and not to go down the wrong path even further. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said Beijing will resolutely safeguard its sovereign security and development interests. That after the U.S. condemned China over planned reforms to Hong Kong's electoral system, claiming the move is aimed at pushing back democracy in the city. A top Chinese government official has, however, defended the decision, saying the reform coupled with last year's security law would help manage the chaos in the city. Apart from Hong Kong, the world's two economic powers are at odds over other issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Despite repeated warnings, the U.S. Navy on Thursday announced the sailing of a warship through the Taiwan Strait, claiming it was a routine transit of the USS John Finn. It was the third such voyage through waters separating mainland China and Taiwan since President Joe Biden took office. Still, China has called on the U.S. to bring the bilateral relations back on the right track through objective and rational mechanisms. It also called on the U.S. to stop interfering in China's internal affairs. The call followed a series of rhetoric by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who alleged that China is a challenge to the security and values of Washington and its allies. American and Chinese officials are scheduled to hold a cliffhanger meeting next week in Alaska, which will be the first diplomatic overture since Biden entered the White House. The outcome might improve or worsen the already tense relations between the two.
New York's embattled governor says he won't resign over accusations of sexually harassing seven women, even as he apologized for making them feel uncomfortable. This comes after a formal investigation was launched to examine claims by six women that Cuomo sexually harassed them. The seventh woman came forward Friday, saying she was subjected to his unwanted touching. On Friday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand both from New York, became the latest high-profile Democrats to call for Cuomo's resignation. In a joint statement, the two described allegations of sexual harassment against Cuomo credible, saying he has lost the confidence of people and his governing parties. Staying in the U.S. and the city of Minneapolis, which has agreed to pay $27 million to settle a lawsuit filed by the family of murdered African-American George Floyd over his death in police custody.
In this historic agreement, the largest pretrial settlement in a police civil rights wrongful death case in U.S. history makes a statement that George Floyd deserved better than what we witnessed on May 25th, 2020. That George Floyd's life matters, and by extension, Black lives matter.
Floyd's relatives sued the city and the four police officers that were involved in his death last year. It is not yet clear if the city is admitting wrongdoing as part of the settlement. Floyd's brother, Rodney, said the agreement is a necessary step for his family to get some closure.
One thing that the world needs to know, America, we need to heal. This nation needs healing. Our family needs healing.
Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is currently on trial on murder and manslaughter charges in connection with Floyd's death last May. Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. Three other police officers were also charged. 46-year-old Floyd died as he continually gasped, "Please, I can't breathe," triggering massive rallies and clashes with police in many cities across the U.S. and other parts of the world. Turning to other news now, and Brazil surpasses India to become the country with the second highest number of coronavirus cases in the world. Brazil's total number of infections soared past 11.3 million after the Latin American country logged over 85,000 new cases. The country has the world's second highest COVID-19 death toll with over 275,000 fatalities. Brazil has registered more than 2,200 new deaths for the third day in a row. The South American country is grappling with a surge in cases due to a highly contagious new local variant that has pushed many hospitals close to the breaking point. Professor of International Studies Bruno Lima Rocha says the government of Brazil is responsible for the crisis the country is facing.
I would say that President Jair Bolsonaro and his so-called health minister, Eduardo Pazuello, I insist, three-star general in the Brazilian army, they are the most responsible for the spread of the COVID-19 in Brazil. Both of them, Jair Bolsonaro and Eduardo Pazuello. They are struggling against medicine, against science, against Medicare, and against the anticipation of buying millions of vaccines. Now, only now in March 2021, we are trying to buy the Russian vaccine Sputnik. And even, I suppose it's a good thing. The Supreme Court allowed state governors and mayors to buy by themselves or local consortiums other vaccines. So, for example, the nine states of Northeastern, they bought themselves, or they're trying to buy themselves, 39 million doses of Sputnik. By the way, the health minister, they are trying to buy themselves, federal government, federal administration, only 10 million doses. I don't know why. Maybe they are doing a miserable political calculus to associate themselves against COVID and spreading, I would say, the negationist, the denial of the COVID.
Meanwhile, the number of coronavirus infections in South Korea has reached its highest level in 3 weeks as authorities prepare for a broader vaccine rollout. The country recorded 490 new cases in the past 24 hours, bringing the total infections to over 95,000. Most cases were locally transmitted, with nearly 70% of them being in the capital, Seoul, and its neighboring areas. The death toll stands at 1,600. According to local media, the government is planning to begin immunization of the general public, starting with healthcare workers and the elderly people from next month. Meanwhile, Australia has reported the first locally transmitted COVID infection in more than 2 weeks, triggering restrictions in hospital areas. Australia has so far recorded over 29,000 infections and less than 1,000 deaths. Two more people have died in Myanmar amid ongoing protests against the military rule. Security forces opened fire at a crowd of protesters in the commercial capital, Yangon, overnight, killing two of them. The violence took place outside a police station where the protesters gathered to demand the release of people arrested previously. More than 70 people have been killed since a military coup toppled the government of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi on February the 1st. Suu Kyi and many of her cabinet members are in custody. The Southeast Asian nation has been the scene of widespread protests and strikes. The junta has unleashed a harsh crackdown on street protests and civil disobedience. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance, during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
Limelight. 2 years ago, a coalition of civil rights leaders calling themselves the 200 brought a legal suit against the California Air Resources Board, or CARB, the main agency of the California government responsible for implementing climate policies. The lawsuit charged these policies were systematically violating the rights of minority citizens in the state, particularly those living in poverty. We're prepared through an article written by Jonathan Tenenbaum, titled California Horror Scenario Could Sink Biden. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Jonathan Tenenbaum's article. Climate fundamentalists tend to believe in sacrifice and regimentation as the only way to avert a climate apocalypse and atone for man's crimes against the earth. In his campaign, US President Joe Biden set a very different tone. His climate plan would make building a new zero-emission infrastructure for the United States into a vehicle for restoring prosperity and high-wage employment. But what will President Biden's clean energy future look like? And will it be economically sustainable? A policy of attempting to achieve 100% clean electricity without massive expansion of nuclear energy will inevitably mean subjecting the population to economic austerity, among other things, through exorbitantly high energy prices and taxes, resulting in a loss in buying power and most likely rationing and regimentation in the use of electricity. Plus blackouts. To get a bitter taste of that future, we have only to look at California, the state that has taken the lead in clean energy. California also leads with the highest energy prices outside of the Northeast, more than 50% higher than the national average, and the highest real poverty rate in the United States. California is supposed to be the showcase of the Democratic Party's environmental policies. The state has been solidly in Democratic hands since the election of environmentalist Governor Jerry Brown in 2011. Vice President Kamala Harris and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi are leading California Democrats. California also has vast financial and economic resources. If California were a country, it would be one of the 6 richest nations in the world, with a nominal gross domestic product of $2.6 trillion. So why is this state not able to provide its citizens with reliable and affordable electric power? Throughout October of last year, millions of Californians suffered from a constant series of rolling blackouts in which electricity supply was cut off to various regions of the state on a rotating basis. Rolling blackouts were provoked by a severe heat and dry spell, but were made possible by the desolate state of the state's ancient electric power grid. Sparking from its overland power lines had long been a main trigger of California's frequent forest fires. To avert this danger during the heat wave, California's main supply company, Pacific Gas and Electricity, PG&E, simply cut off electricity to entire areas, calling these events public safety power shutoffs. Pacific Gas and Electricity, the largest power company in the United States and greatly concerned to cultivate its image as a pioneer in clean energy, had evidently given more priority to investing in solar and wind power than maintaining the power grid. The crisis was also caused by insufficient reserves of generation capacity, including the environmentally motivated reduction in natural gas-based power generation and closing of the next to last nuclear plant, as well as phasing out of fossil fuel plants in neighboring states, which reduced the amount of electricity that could be imported. With net imports amounting to 25% of its supplies, California is the largest importer of electricity in the United States. Then there were the large fluctuations in supply from wind turbines, with swings of up to 1,000 megawatts, and the unavailability of solar power at night. At a certain point, the situation got out of hand. The latest crisis was no surprise for those familiar with California's energy system. California already led the country in the number of power outages per year, and the system had already come near to collapse in the preceding months. More important than mere blackouts, California gives a foretaste of the economic austerity that ideologically driven climate measures threaten to bring to the whole country. Years ago, a coalition of civil rights leaders calling themselves the 200 brought a legal suit against the California Air Resources Board, or CARB, the main agency of the California government responsible for implementing climate policies. The lawsuit charged these policies were systematically violating the rights of minority citizens in the state, particularly those living in poverty. By the U.S. Census Bureau's functional poverty criteria, 18% of Californians are considered poor. California's environmental measures have been hitting the living standards of the poorer population in multiple ways. Rapidly increasing cost of electricity, plus 30% since 2011, compared with a 4% average increase in the rest of the United States. Growth in the cost of housing arising from obligatory energy efficiency measures in old and new buildings and other environmental regulations. Moves towards banning the use of natural gas for heating and cooking, forcing people to turn instead to the use of electricity, which is nearly four times more expensive. Increased transportation costs due to environmental taxes on motor fuels and a new vehicle miles traveled fee, designed to reduce emissions from car driving, but de facto punishing people who move to outlying areas in search of affordable housing. President Joe Biden and his team are well aware of the link between climate policy and austerity. It has been a major issue at the base of the Democratic Party, with an ideologically driven leftist constituency on one side and traditional Democratic constituencies such as trade unions on the other. The latter, from experience and common sense, fear they will end up paying for the clean energy policies with lower living standards and also increased unemployment. For example, what will happen to the millions of persons whose livelihoods depend, directly or indirectly, on coal mining, natural gas, and oil extraction activities? One should bear in mind the colossal size of the fossil fuel sector in the United States economy. The United States is currently the largest oil producer in the world, the largest natural gas producer, and the third largest hard coal producer. A radical reduction in fossil fuel production would hit not only the 1.1 million people directly employed in these activities, but also the economies of entire regions in states such as Wyoming, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas, North Dakota, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. Needless to say, most of these regions voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in the last election. President Joe Biden knows this, of course. In executive orders, he promises that 40% of the benefits of the $2 trillion climate plan will go to disadvantaged communities. Biden claims that large numbers of people in these communities will find employment in the process of shutting down the fossil fuel sector, such as closing down mines, sealing off oil wells, dismantling pipelines, restoring the surrounding, often severely damaged environment, decommissioning fossil fuel plants. This may be partly true, although the jobs involved have only a marginal effect on the productivity of the U.S. economy. But what happens later? The experiences of the Rust Belt, resulting from the deindustrialization of the United States Midwest and parts of the Northeast in the 1980s, are not particularly encouraging. This looks good at first glance, but it reflects the fact that solar and wind energy are extremely labor-intensive and have intrinsically low productivity. This is due, among other things, to the huge number of units that must be installed and maintained in order to reach a given output level. The critical question is whether the US economy, after having spent all the money and resources to reach 100% clean energy, will be more or less productive. The answer depends crucially on the choices of technology. President Joe Biden emphasized in his campaign, a key plank of our Build Back Better recovery plan is building a modern, resilient climate infrastructure and clean energy future that will create millions of good-paying union jobs, not $7, $8, $10, $12 an hour, but prevailing wage and benefits. However, if irrational environmentalist policies collapse the real productivity of the economy, then real wages and real living standards will inevitably collapse too, at least for the majority of the working population. Large injections of money might create the opposite impression, but, as in the case of every anesthetic, the effect eventually wears off.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. I'm Saeed Bourza. We begin with the Syrian war, in which several European countries have been involved and is now a decade old. Hundreds of thousands have been killed, millions displaced, and the country's infrastructure is on its knees. And as Murtaza Jaffa reports, the artillery fire may have largely quieted, but the campaign of regime change is still in play.
10 brutal years have passed in Syria. A decade of upheaval, conflict, and displacement, with no end in sight. While military campaigns have somewhat abated, the human suffering is reaching an all-time high. Western-backed groups suffered their greatest defeats in 2017 and 18. But since then, the US and the EU have ramped up economic sanctions designed to starve the country into regime change. Earlier in the week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated no end to sanctions, no normalization, and no support for reconstruction until a political transition. The effects have been harrowing. According to the World Food Programme, in the last year alone, millions of Syrians have fallen into severe levels of poverty. And with the global pandemic, the situation is bordering critical.
You have COVID, you have loss of the value of the currency itself, and then you have mass displacement. So when you put all of these things together, there is no surprise that we are seeing rising food insecurity, rising hunger. People are closer to starvation today than ever before.
According to the UN, the price of food is now 33 times higher than before the war, with an estimated 12.5 million people struggling to find enough food each day. Similar numbers can be found amongst the 5.6 million refugees now living in neighboring countries. Rates of suicide and self-harm are now beginning to rise.
I don't know what to think. The way I see my sisters and my parents, especially my mother, she has tried to hurt herself on more than one occasion. I did try one time too, to commit suicide. I went to the roof of this building. My father followed me. I was about to jump, and my father grabbed me. Our situation is very difficult.
The last 10 years have also seen efforts to find a political solution, with talks in Geneva, Vienna, and Doha. But if Western sanctions persist, then talks are ultimately futile. For many, any lasting resolution can only be brokered by the Syrians themselves. Only time will tell if or when this can be achieved.
Let's discuss that with Elijah Magnier. He's in Brussels. He's a veteran war correspondent joining me now. Good to have you on the show. What do you think of the Syrian people feeling after a decade of war in a country where even toothpaste is subject to sanctions?
Thank you for having me. Well, first of all, I think the Syrians realize that they are under harsh sanctions from the U.S., and the U.S. only is responsible for these sanctions, plus the EU, who are imposing sanctions on the Syrian population. The Americans are occupying northeast Syria, and they are preventing the Syrian government from using the oil that belongs to the Syrian and it is stolen by the Americans. And not only that, it is a large part of the country that represents 23% of the geographic area of Syria, and it is one of the richest in agriculture. That is the main reason behind the suffering and the starvation of the population. Moreover, allow me to add something very important, which is the Western will to prevent the Syrian refugees from returning home. So what Mr. Borrell wants to say in his speech, as you rightly presented it, when he says five countries, five armies are in Syria, he forgot to say that the Turkey and Americans armies are occupying Syria. They were never invited into Syria. And what he's trying to say also, he is afraid of the elections. They don't want the return of the Syrian refugees. they handsomely paying the government of Turkey, of Lebanon and Jordan to keep the Syrian refugee so they don't return and they don't vote for their president. And this is exactly what they don't want to see, because they know President Assad is going to win.
It's been 10 years since the war began. What does the future hold for Syria, do you think? And do you have any hope at all in the various peace talks that have been have taken place up to now?
Well, the Americans stated very clearly, I mean, we just need to quote them. They said, we are there to make sure that the Russian will sink into the Syrian quagmire, and we are there to see the Russian failing in Syria. And we also want Assad to be removed. And then they say, we don't want a regime change. But in their action, they're preventing oil and food to reach Syria. So the population is very much aware of that. And people have no other choice but to wait and see when the Americans and the Europeans will understand that sanctions never worked. They've never worked on Venezuela. They didn't work on Iran. They're not working in Syria. They're not working in Lebanon. And this is not the way to change the regime. The only way to change regime is by the population who vote for their leaders. And we saw in Iran the sanctions since 1979, the Americans didn't achieve anything but the starvation of the population. Therefore, in Syria, no, I'm afraid there is no much hope, because Biden is confused. There are no good solutions for Biden in Syria. He doesn't want to pull out from the borders with Iraq because he doesn't want to allow the Syrians to regain the commerce and the health they want to regain after all these years, 10 years of war. He doesn't want to pull out from the north Syria. He wants to keep the Turkey there that is occupying also northwest, and he wants to protect the Kurds. So he's not going to leave, and he wants to continue the same situation as it is and leave it.
As you say, sanctions. Ineffective, but convenient, perhaps. Elijah Magnier in Brussels, thank you. Moving on now to a joint military exercise conducted by Greece, Greek Cyprus, Israel, and France in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea in an effort to assert dominance over the region. Dubbed Noble Dina, the drills covered search-rescue operations, anti-submarine warfare, and scenarios simulating battle between warships. Greece and Greek Cyprus are currently locked in a bitter dispute with Turkey over hydrocarbon resources in the disputed Mediterranean Sea. Top diplomats from France, Germany, Egypt, and Jordan have met to discuss possible peace efforts for Palestine and Israel ahead of upcoming elections. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said the next steps for Middle East peace depend on the outcome of the Israeli election on March 23rd. His comments come only weeks after the International Criminal Court announced it would be investigating alleged war crimes committed by Israeli forces. The Israeli regime has condemned the investigation as anti-Semitic. An EU study has found that the COVID-19 pandemic has wiped out approximately 6 million jobs across the bloc. The study says younger workers have experienced the sharpest decline in employment. Spain, France, Poland, Italy, and Greece were particularly affected as a result of economically suffocating lockdowns. According to the study, the pandemic has also disproportionately affected female-dominated sectors, including accommodation, food, and travel.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Days after that bombshell Oprah Winfrey interview involving two former members of the British royal family, Prince William, Queen Elizabeth's older grandson, has insisted that the royal family isn't full of racists. Richard Sudan joins me now with his take and the social media reaction. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed, and good to be with you again. Yes, so Prince William, possible future King of Britain, has made the first statement from the royal family following the bombshell claims in the interview with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. And the statement by Prince William was made during a visit to a school, I think in East London. It's quite an interesting statement. People are talking about it.
They have said they're going to deal with the matter privately, Richard, but I don't think it's going to be possible.
Well, maybe not. And I think what's interesting is, arguably, if there wasn't damage to the royal family and their reputation, would Prince William have felt the need to answer the question from the journalist? You know, the language is a bit revealing as well, people are saying. Prince William said, very much not racist. Some people might say, you're just simply either racist or you're not. And actually, other people are asking the question, was it indeed Prince William who was alleged to have asked Harry about the skin colour of his future baby? Yeah. All questions that are up in the air, really. And just a another point, there's an interesting picture actually circulating online of Prince William that people are really saying speaks for itself and speaks volumes about his perhaps track record or position on racism. And actually, there's some interesting reactions online. In the regard of the picture we just saw, Saeed, there's an interesting reaction from Hector on Twitter, who says, only if Prince William knew that racism and white supremacy is not only expressed by words, deeds and actions are more than sufficient to identify those traits. And we have another reaction from Darkseid, who says, I don't know why the journalist asked Prince William, is the royal family a racist family? Did he really expect him to say anything but no? So, a couple of reactions there, Saeed, but this discussion debate is raging online continually as we speak.
And we will be covering it moving forward. Let's take a look at your second story, Richard. Israel collaborating with the United Arab Emirates to develop anti-drone defense technology. What do we know about that?
Exactly. Well, of course, this is part of the increasing normalization deal that we've seen happen between the two countries. Israel's aerospace industries will work with the United Arab Emirates weapons maker Edge. And this was announced yesterday, and it was announced off the back of a phone call between Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of Abu Dhabi. And, you know, they announced that these two companies will work together to develop quote-unquote anti-drone technology. But for most experts and analysts, this really translates as weapons development. And actually, you know, people have got a clear view, really, of the kinds of weapons and the purpose of which they'll be used for. There was the announcement of $10 billion worth of investment from the UAE to Israel in quote-unquote different sectors, and this is all off the back of this phone call between the two leaders. Now, what's really interesting is most people that have got a keen eye on what Israel has been doing has said, look, these weapons will undoubtedly or quite possibly end up being used against the Palestinians who are occupied in their own country, you know, and this is acknowledged by international law and most serious human rights observers. And it's interesting that this announcement comes off the back of the recent announcement by the ICC that they are conducting a probe into possible alleged war crimes by Israel in the Gaza Strip and elsewhere. So this story has raised eyebrows and actually alarm bells for many people, say.
Let's hear from some of those people, Richard.
Absolutely. Let's go first to Samuel, who says, big story here, Israel Aerospace and the UAE Edge will cooperate on building anti-drone technology, and this is a warning shot to both Iran and Turkey. And we have a reaction on Twitter from Hassan Sajwani, who ironically says he tweets about counter-terrorism, and he seems to find it funny that Israel is developing more weapons with the UAE to potentially commit war crimes. And he says, imagine the UAE and Israel developing weapons together. Gaza will not sleep tonight. And would you believe, Saeed, Benjamin Netanyahu's son reacted to the tweet from Hassan Sajwani, and he expressed his support in the form of emojis, signaling his approval of a Twitter exchange, which frankly, many people find very distasteful, to say the least.
Who would have thought, Richard? Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you.
human remains found in a woodland in Kent, a county in southeastern England, have been confirmed as those of Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old who was kidnapped and murdered, presumably by a serving British police officer. Ahmed Kabbala joins me now with more details and how social media has reacted to it all. Ahmed, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Yeah, it's a shocking story, and it sent shockwaves throughout the UK because just the gruesome nature of what's alleged to have happened. And there's this article by The Sun. Now, The Sun is a disreputable paper, so many will take what they say with a pinch of salt. But nonetheless, they say that the police officer who's been accused may have used his ID to entice the 33-year-old into the car and may have even used COVID regulations as a pretext, which shows a very malice intent in this crime. And this crime has shocked many, myself included, because as a man, I had no idea about the level of threat and danger that many women throughout the UK face. And because of the actions on social media, because of the testimonies, very powerful testimonies that we've heard over the last couple of days, we found out that this is not an isolated incident, but many women are concerned for their safety when walking through the streets of Britain. And a recent YouGov poll actually backs this up, because it showed that 97% of young women have been sexually harassed in public space, and 80% of all women have been harassed. And what's interesting about this is that they don't feel, the same YouGov poll says they do not feel comfortable reporting this to the authorities because they do not believe that the authorities will take their concerns seriously. Now, this case involving a city metropolitan police officer is only going to exacerbate that lack of faith in the authorities to deal with sexual assaults. So we've got a fierce reaction on social media. We've got a tweet from Olivia. She says, "I think Sarah Everard really hits home with everyone and has taken over social media because we all know at least one person where a similar situation has happened to them. Enough is enough." Harriet Johnson, who is a barrister, says, "Every woman you know has taken a longer route, has doubled back on herself, has pretended to dawdle by a shop window, has had her keys in her hand, has made a phone call, has rounded a corner and run. Every woman you know has walked home scared. Every woman you know." And it really does speak to why this story has resonated with so many. And the UK, quite frankly, needs to do a lot more, particularly as it preaches to other nations around the world regarding women's rights, when clearly it needs to get its own house in order because women are telling us that they do not feel safe.
Reclaim these streets, Ahmed, is the hashtag that's been trending. It's now in the hands of the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, to allow that socially distanced vigil to be held for Sarah Everard. We'll wait and see if it will indeed go ahead Saturday. Now to your second story, an update on the case of Derek Chauvin, the now former police officer in Minneapolis, states, who stands accused of murdering George Floyd.
Yes, so the George Floyd trial will officially begin on the 29th of March. At the moment, they're in jury selection. And due to pressure by protesters and the prosecution, the judge presiding over the case has had to add third-degree murder to the second-degree murder charge, which means that there's more likely going to be a case of conviction. However, some are worried because we've seen high-profile cases in the past where it looked an open and shut case and the police officer involved has been acquitted. So some are sceptical because of the history of the jury siding with the police in this situation, particularly in the situation where the jury selection is done in a way where anyone that's been to a Black Lives Matter protest, anyone who is critical of Black Lives Matter or sympathetic to the traumatic experience George Floyd and his family have been through, is likely to be dismissed. Now, you've got to ask yourself, who, unless you're living under a rock, who hasn't seen the death of George Floyd? Who hasn't probably been to a Black Lives Matter protest? So this is a way of kind of stacking the jury in favor of those that might have a sympathetic ear or perception to the police force. And there was actually a questionnaire issued out that asked people, what do you think about Blue Lives Matter? And this is another way of kind of weeding out those that might reach a conclusion that the Minnesota Police Department might find unfavorable. Now, we've got some social media reaction. Jack says, breaking. Juror 36 notes that if George Floyd had complied with officers, this wouldn't have happened. And this juror was selected despite this comment. Candice Owens says, George Floyd had multiple autopsies performed, and they all concluded the same. He did not die from compression to his throat. He was a drug addict who had enough drugs in him to overdose. The facts are that Derek Chauvin did not cause his death. Now, final tweet, we've got time. He says, please cite the multiple autopsies that concluded that, because multiple autopsies also concluded that the knee on the neck was a contributing factor, and two autopsies concluded the knee on the neck would have likely killed him without drugs in his system.
Ahmed Cabello, thanks for all that. And that's all the time we have for this broadcast. Bye for now.
The Limelight.